The Thunderbolt, tied up to the dock, did not live up to her name. She looked like the sway-backed old icebreaker that she was, new coat of paint and polished fittings or no. Her 230-foot length had a high prow, a deep well deck, and her castle amidships. Just below the bridge in the bow was the 5-inch gun, her main armament. On the other side of the castle, a 20-millimeter Orlikon looked like an avant-garde sculpture under its protective cover. Valentine's Marines were responsible for it and the four 7.62mm machine guns in action. They lay ready to be placed in the mounts on either side of the ship, more or less at the corners of the upper deck of the square main cabin. As she was now configured, she carried four commissioned officers and seven warrant officers, supervising divisions of 45 Coastal Patrol crewmen and 34 Coastal Marines. Usually she patrolled with a higher proportion of CP, fewer Marines, and more spaces for all concerned, but she had been modified to carry troops this trip. The captain had made no secret of their mission. A nest of pirates and terrorists on the island of Jamaica had been bold enough to trouble the continental coast. The Thunderbolt and crew was to capture, scuttle, or burn the pirates' ships and destroy their base. The gunboat had little to fear in return. She could stand off and sink the pirates in their harbor or on the sea, for the sail-driven brigands had no gun to match the 5-inch cannon, and nothing short of naval gunfire, mines, or torpedoes could penetrate the icebreaker's hull. Whatever her hoped-for glories, the Thunderbolt looked dismal enough in the pre-dawn gloom as she waited in her berth. A light burned at the entry port at the end of the gangway, and a glow from the bridge revealed the outline of the officer of the watch. A duty officer came to attention.
Mr. Rowan, sir.
The man did not acknowledge Anka. Valentine looked forward and aft. Anka's labor team lay in a snoring heap at the stern. Frowning, he turned on Anka.
If your gang is gonna sleep like that on deck, you might as well get them some bedding. You have permission to get it out of ship's stores.
Sir. Thank you, sir.
Anka gave a quick bow.
Hope they wash it afterwards. We got enough bugs already.
Forward, Valentine saw the red glow of a cigarette. The chief sat on a stool, his legs up on the rail, and an ankle comfortably cradled in a machine gun mount, watching the rainfall. In a complement of more than 80, Valentine's confidants consisted of the grog next to him and the chief by the rail. He moved forward. Obviously, the chief was waiting for him to return.
Good evening, Captain Rowan.
The cat paused and rested his elbows on the rail, looking out at the drizzle. Chief Engineer Landberg, like Valentine, had a strong dash of Native American blood in him, giving his title an ethnic twist which he bore with good humor. Though not a tall man, he had a wide wrestler's torso supported by pillar-like legs. Unlike his body, his face was soft and rounded, a textbook example of the kind of face described as apple-cheeked. The chief had been an informer for Southern Command since his youth, but until this run, limited his service to simple intelligence gathering. The rain had washed the air clean of the usual fetid river odors. All Valentine could smell was the vaguely metallic tang of the ship, new paint, and the chief's burning tobacco.
What's the matter, chief? Can't sleep?
Valentine looked back over his shoulder. The sentry probably couldn't hear them over the weather, but no sense taking chances.
Nah. The sound of the rain on this biscuit tin keep me awake sometime, so I just come up and watch you fall.
How's that fuel pump coming? I'd really like to get underway. The men are getting anxious.
Landberg looked up, swallowed. Valentine gave him a nod.
They are, huh?
The engineer pinched his lower lip between thumb and forefinger when overhauling a problem. He would pull out his lower lip, then release it so it hit his upper lip and teeth with a tiny clip.
Wow, I reckon good news should wait. I got sick of waiting on a part, so I found something I could modify with just a little machining. I'll try it right now if you want. And we can let the captain know if it works. These delays been driving that old man nuts.
Good work, chief.
Valentine left the chief to finish his tobacco and thoughts. He was committed now. By this time tomorrow, he would be at sea, with only Anka and the chief set against the captain and crew, backed up by the Kurian system that controlled them. Were it not for the rock-steady support of Anka, as imperturbable as a mountain, and the chief's wily aid, his quest would have foundered long ago. Valentine climbed one of the metal staircases running up the castle side to the bridge and asked the watch officer to call him at dawn and retired to his shared cabin. Originally, only he and the captain were given their own cabins, but after he saw the crowded conditions on board, Valentine invited Lieutenant Post to share his cabin. Post got quietly drunk each night, duty or no, and Valentine felt for him after hearing some of the jibes hurled with casual viciousness by the other wardroom members. He looked down at Post, a sleeping ruin of what must once have been a physical archetype of a man. His 6'3 frame didn't fit on the bed, from his salt and pepper hair to rarely washed feet, breathing in the restless, shallow sleep of alcoholic oblivion. As usual, he hadn't bothered to undress before turning in, and would attend to his duties tomorrow in a wrinkled uniform, permanent stains marking the armpits and back. Post ignored even the captain's comments about his appearance, but in some fit of contrariness, shaved each morning after Valentine had once privately mentioned over coffee that he would have a terrible time keeping his Marines clean-shaved if his lieutenant sprouted 3 days' worth of stubble. Valentine began to remove his shoes. Above him, a railed shelf held his meager collection of books. Father Max's gilt-edged Bible. The old northern Minnesota priest had raised him after his family's murder and died of pneumonia while he was training Foxtrot Company. The Padre had willed the aged tome to him. It had arrived while he and Duvalier were seeking the Twisted Cross on the Great Plains. Next to the Bible were his battered old Livy histories, brought down when he first joined up with the cause 8 years ago. He owned copies of Clausewitz's On War and a Chinese army translation of Sun Tzu, volumes he'd had to study at the military college in Pine Bluff, Arkansas, as he'd been studying for his commission. His American Civil War histories were next. Sam Wafkin's Company H and Frisch's Lincoln, Leadership to Liberty. Then came his little collection of fiction, Watership Down, its yellowed pages stitched together and ironically rebound in rabbit skin, given to him as a welcome home gift by the craftsman, a wolf named Gonzalez, who survived their ill-fated courier mission to Lake Michigan in 2065. Next to it, and in much better shape, was a recent hardcover of the complete set of the Sherlock Holmes stories. Then there was his latest acquisition, a copy of Gone with the Wind bought at a New Orleans bookstore. He'd seen his fellow infiltrator Duvalier reading it last year while he was undergoing coastal marine training in Biloxi, Mississippi. Shocked to find her so deep into such a brick of a book, he'd made some comment about the four-color cover. "Ever read it?" she'd asked. When he admitted that he hadn't, she told him not to offer an opinion out of ignorance. Sensing a challenge when he heard one, he sat down with it his first free day, intending to mock it and her, but within 20 minutes was so captivated that he went out and treated himself to a bottle of cognac to enjoy with the epic. The rest of the shelf held mostly unread Korean propaganda and service bulletins. There was a quiet knock at the door.
Naturally.
A 12-year-old boy in a uniform two sizes too big for him stood in the corridor. The crew called him and his twin brother P1 and P2, being identical twins sent to sea in the care of their uncle, one of the petty officers. The captain, sick of not being able to tell them apart, flipped a coin and had all the hair shaved from P1's young head. Under a messy shock of sun-white hair, P2 looked up at Valentine with piercing blue eyes.
"Sir, the captain's passing the word for you, Mr. Rowan. He wants to see you in his cabin."
"Tell the captain I'm coming."
"Aye, aye, sir."
P2 turned and moved 6 feet up the passageway toward the captain's door. The captain was not the sort of man to just knock on the wall or come himself. Valentine retied his boots, wishing he had just 5 minutes out of them. He walked the short distance to the captain's cabin. He smoothed out his uniform unconsciously and knocked.
"Come."
Captain Saunders fancied himself a species of tough old seahawk, but to Valentine, he seemed more like a rather aged rooster. The heavy wattles hanging under his chin were hardly hawk-like, and the full head of gray hair that was the captain's pride and joy was brushed up into a bantam's pompadour. Perhaps something hawkish flickered in the stare of his hard hazel eyes, between which a beak of a nose matching that of the mightiest of eagles, if not a toucan, arched out in its Roman majesty.
"You pass the word for me, sir?"
The captain was in one of his work-all-night fits, and Valentine tried his best to look alert.
"Ah, Captain Rowan. Are the Marines ready to go to sea?"
"Of course, sir."
"Good. You'll be glad to know we'll be leaving in the morning. The fuel pump is repaired. I had to light a fire under the chief, but if properly motivated, the man can work wonders.
Valentine blanked his expression. He looked around at the small day cabin. The captain sat behind a massive desk that must have been brought in sections, then reassembled. It dwarfed the other chairs in the room. A few pictures, all of Captain Saunders in various stages of his career or of ships he had officered, decorated the walls.
Glad to hear it, sir. The waiting has been hard.
It's finally over. Keen to get to sea, I hope. Ready for the smell of burning sail.
At your order, sir. One thing, though, sir. I still haven't had any luck finding a reliable team of rangers. Something must be going on inland. I've tried through channels and I've tried out of channels, but all I can find are kids or old men.
Valentine was more than half telling the truth for once.
The Grog labor team is a combat squad on paper. I'd like to just keep them, sir.
What about quartering them? We're crowded enough. The men won't share with Grogs.
We can rig some kind of shelter on the well deck, sir. Tents would do.
Captain Saunders thought for a moment.
Very well. They can eat the leftovers. Stretch the stores. I understand Grogs aren't too particular. Put that foreman of theirs in charge of squaring them away. I'd like to depart at dawn. And you'll be welcome on the bridge at 6 a.m. We'll take her out right after breakfast.
Close to 2 hours of sleep.
Valentine sagged in relief.
Thank you, sir.
One thing, though, Captain Rowan. I'd like you and the exec to do a final weapons inventory. You'll do your marines in the small arms locker, and he'll cover the heavy weapons. Wouldn't want to reach Jamaica and find your men's rifles had been left dockside by accident. For the want of a nail, am I right?
The prospect of sleep evaporated like a desert mirage.
Yes, sir. Speaking of small arms, I had to give over my revolver for barter for some parts the chief needed. I'll need a new pistol from the ship's arms.
Rowan, you have to learn to throw your weight a little more. Greasing palms with your sidearms? Still, if it helped get us to sea, I'm grateful. Anyway, get that inventory done. That was item one, business. Item two is pleasure. I'd like your company at dinner tonight, a tradition of mine, to celebrate the beginning of what we all hope will be a successful cruise. Mr. Post is invited too, of course. Number one uniforms, please. That will encourage your lieutenant to clean himself up.
Yes, sir. Thank you, sir.
That's all for now. See to your men, Rowan.
Aye, aye, sir.
Valentine shut the cabin door softly behind him and began his day's work. He hardly noticed the ship pulling away from the dock and moving downriver, so busy was he with final preparations. The executive officer, Lieutenant Worthington, started on the heavy weapons inventory, then begged off as the engines were turned over to attend to duties on the bridge. Valentine, who had little to do with the actual handling of the ship, was glad to be rid of him and offered to finish Worthington's part of the barely begun job. The exec, though 2 years older than he, had not seen much action and assumed Valentine to be a man of vast experience to be a captain of Marines in his mid-20s. He had the annoying habit of wanting particulars of the various real and faked incidents in Valentine's Captain Rowan dossier. Valentine did not wish to discuss the faked events out of fear of slipping up on some detail, and the memories of the real incidents seen from the sidelines in the service of Kerr troubled him too much to want to talk about them for the entertainment of a callow fellow officer. Inventory and inspection done, he just had time to change into his best uniform before dinner. Naturally, the dinner began with a toast over the cloth-covered folding table that had been set up for the meal. Worthington raised his glass of wine, an import brought all the way from western Mexico. The captain and exec sat opposite each other, stiff in their crisp black uniforms, the captain's solid gold buttons engraved with Illuminati eye and anchor. Valentine and Post, in their brass-buttoned navy blue, filled the other places on the square table.
The Thunderbolt, Queen of the Gulf.
Saunders sipped with a connoisseur's thoughtful appreciation. Post drained his glass in a single motion. Worthington barely tasted his. Valentine took a welcome mouthful, grateful to just be off his feet. The wine hit him hard, and he fought to keep from falling asleep in his soup. A winter salad followed. The captain and the exec did most of the talking, discussing the pilot's navigation of the treacherous, shifting sandbars at the mouth of the Mississippi and the balance of the stores on the ship. Valentine was content to eat his main course, a fresh fillet of Texas beef smothered in onions and mushrooms, in exhausted silence. Post, who had been encouraged by Valentine to mend his best uniform and press it to celebrate the freedom of being at sea and away from the humid air of New Orleans, finished the bottle and started on another of less illustrious vintage.
Captain Rowan!
The captain's voice broke in through the mists of Valentine's fatigue.
Sir?
Lieutenant Worthington asked you a question about the grogs.
My apologies, Lieutenant.
Valentine brought himself back to the dinner with an effort.
I'm not myself tonight. What was the question?
Seasickness, Captain Rowan?
A smile that was half sneer crept across his face.
We're still on the river.
Probably.
I just wanted your opinion on Uncle's grogs. We were really hoping for some ranges for the inshore scouting work.
The men on the ship called Anka Uncle, and Anka was too well-mannered among their enemies to correct them. In the Ozark Free Territory, he would have flattened someone who could not be bothered to learn to pronounce his name correctly.
Uncle says they're combat-trained. I'll vouch for his word.
It's your responsibility, of course.
By now, Valentine knew that that phrase was Saunders speak, meaning that if the grogs failed in some way, the blame would be passed to Valentine.
I'm sure we can keep them busy on the ship. I've never had any experience with grogs in combat. I've heard they leave something to be desired.
Fine marksmen, though. Good eyes and ears.
But as scouts, Rowan, as scouts?
Like dogs who can shoot guns. Not a whole lot smarter than a dog, though. Decision-making isn't their forte. They'll come back and hoot at you just to let you know they've found something. Uncle can make more sense out of their tongue than I can.
Very well, Captain Rowan. That settles my mind, knowing you are confident in the matter. I'm sure they'll be an asset.
The rest of the evening passed in the captain telling stories to his captive audience. Valentine leaned back in his chair, keeping his eyes open while his brain turned itself off. He shifted his gaze to Post, who had restricted his conversation to a few polite phrases during dinner. His lieutenant remained silent, failing to murmur appreciatively at Saunders' yarns. Post finished the second bottle of wine before turning to the brandy. The Caribbean. An empty, brilliant blue sky is mirrored by an equally blue sea. The gunboat has left the rainy gloom of New Orleans behind her, pushing her hardened prow southeast into the Gulf under the power of her 11-foot propeller at a steady 10 knots. Diesel-electric engines provide the motive force for the propeller, giving her a throbbing, piston-driven heartbeat and sending sky-staining wisps of black carbon into the air from the central smokestack. Below the exhaust, she leaves behind a trail of churned water over a mile long, flanked by the low waves of her wake. The gray ship, with her bleached white decks, flies no flag, letting her armored bulk identify her, leaving the mouth of the Mississippi coasters and fishing ships scattered, parting like an antelope herd with a lion trotting through. The smaller boats fear an inspection shakedown or impressment of valuable crew. But once in the Gulf proper, only a two-mast schooner approached, and even that turned tail and put the wind to her quarter before binoculars and telescopes allowed positive identification. The Kurian masters of the Earth are not a sea-minded race. They avoid blue water and leave its security and commerce to their quislings. There are few armed vessels anymore. The old navies of the world have been broken up for scrap and spare parts. The great tankers, merchant ships, and passenger vessels now lie in their last moorings, giant rolling stones come to barnacle-encrusted rest as the world fell apart. A few have been put to other uses, agricultural workers and what is left of Florida after the great wave that washed across it in 2022, go home from oyster beds, crab farms, and orange groves each night to cruise ships, living in cramped squalor under the last vestiges of the vessel's glitzy luxury of former days. As the sea is out of reach of the Kurians and their reapers, a loose confederation of the waves exists, nomadic ocean-going caravans of anything from a few sailing ships to hundreds, visiting land only in the most unoccupied areas for supplies. But the sea is a cruel provider. She takes her toll in lives as well, probably more than the same number of people would suffer under the Kerr. Some of these bands have turned pirate, raiding rather than trading for necessities the sea and isolated coastline cannot provide. When their depredations become too troublesome, an armed ship is sent to deal with the menace. While they have little use for it, the Kurians won't let a trifling thing like the sea stand between them and vengeance. It was the third day out, and life on the plodding Thunderbolt had already turned into routine. The first light of dawn saw the grogs hosing down and cleaning the decks. They devoured their morning fare with work-sharpened appetite. The cook, his mate, and the officer's steward then cleaned up the kitchen and prepared the meals for everyone else. The men tolerated the presence of the grogs on the ship, especially since they took on so many of the petty labors, but drew the line at eating with them, or indeed sharing the same space. Grogs in tight quarters smell, even to noses not sharpened by the life weavers, like a kennel full of mating ferrets, so they lived on deck in shelters rigged to the bulkheads of the forward well deck. With their routine duties and weapons drill done, Anka gave them leisure to fish. The rod and reel obsession began when a pair of flying fish broke the surface, leaving furrows in the calm ocean in their dash away from the ship. The grogs hooted until Anka reported that his team wanted to know if the sea chickens were good to eat and how they could catch them. Both Valentine and Anka were strangers to deep-sea fishing, so Valentine asked around the crew until one old blue water man, less fastidious than the rest as to who he associated with, descended to the grog deck to teach them how to use the ship's store of fishing poles and reels. Afterwards, the grogs spent every spare moment fashioning lures, rods, and reels. Valentine prevailed on the captain to slow the ship to a crawl for an hour a day when the garbage would be dumped overboard, and the grogs, wild with excitement foreign to human fishermen, pulled in all they could catch. It was just as well, for grog appetites could tax the ship's stores on the three-month patrol. Valentine's particular responsibility was the coastal marines. The coastal patrols looked on the marines as only one rung above the grogs on the evolutionary ladder, and a short rung at that. Gun-toting, useless ballast for most of the trip. Valentine put the rivalry to good use, organizing physical contests between them. Races around the deck, arm wrestling matches, and boxing contests occurred each night, giving the two sides a chance to scream their lungs out, supporting their contestant and abusing the opponent. Not all the diversions were physical. Singing and musical entertainment were often a spontaneous part of the after-dinner leisure hours. As Valentine stood, listening to the music produced by an improvising group of players and singers, he almost forgot these men were technically his sworn enemies. Under different circumstances, he might have been ordered to sneak aboard the ship and plant a bomb that would blow musician, wrestler, and fishing instructor to bloody shreds. All the while, like a long line of storm clouds on Valentine's mental horizon, came the worries about what he had to do and how to go about doing it. Valentine felt for the sailors. The captain believed himself an expert disciplinarian, when in fact his rules verged on pointless sadism. He had an elaborate system of uncomfortable punishments for the last man out of his bunk on a watch, the last man on deck for inspection, the last man in line at mess hall. Since physics required someone to be last, Valentine thought the practice cruel. Spending a watch on watch at the top of the old communications tower without food or water for being shoved out of the way coming up a hatchway improved no one. Of course, the captain's distemper was exacerbated by the ship's radio breaking down after leaving port. Valentine pointed out that their orders demanded radio silence until the pirates were dealt with, so the loss of communications made no difference, but Saunders just grumbled out his familiar want of a nail liturgy again. The executive officer was even worse. Wishing to emulate his captain, thereby showing himself fit for command, Worthington out-heroded Herod in his punishments. Valentine and Post kept their marines busy, and as far from the eyes of Saunders and Worthington as the ship would allow. Valentine felt nervous, bottled up. If he'd been on land, he would have quartered logs and chopped kindling, but there was no firewood to cut on a gunboat at sea. After they grabbed a quick dinner with the marines, they returned to the cabin and undressed. Valentine picked up one of his lieutenant's bottles and sniffed the mouth. It smelled like rubbing alcohol stored in an old boot.
Will, why do you do that to yourself?
The two officers kept to first names when out of uniform.
I'm still trying to figure out why you don't.
Valentine marked the tiny blue veins crisscrossing Post's nose and forehead.
Maybe I want to live a few more years. The way you're going, your liver will abandon ship, or you'll get drummed out. Either way, you'll be finished.
Hear, hear.
Post raised and refilled his glass, his thick features under the salt and pepper hair taking on a red flush.
I figure you for the type to step into the shower, close the curtain, and blow your brains out with your service revolver. The system's rotten, and you know it, same as I.
Post either trusted Valentine or did not care about being turned in. Either way, from their first days sharing a cabin, they began to tentatively express to each other unorthodox opinions about their Kurian masters, but neither had yet expressed it so directly.
Did you lose someone, Will?
I was married once, yeah. Close to 6 years ago now. That's why I tried so hard for officer. Helped us get better housing. But it all went wrong. Not worth talking about. You're lucky. Your wife gives you someone to live for. Not sure I want to even live for me anymore.
Valentine nerved himself for the plunge.
She's not my wife, Will. The license is forged.
Post looked up at him.
Yeah? What, you pretend him for some reason? Might as well get married. That way you don't need false documents to get your allotments. If it goes wrong, just toss her. Plenty other officers have done it. Hasn't hurt their careers one bit.
Valentine opened the door briefly to check the corridor. He shut the door to their cabin again and sat down on the bed opposite Post.
Will, everything about me is faked. Her, my commission and service record from up north, even the name Rowan's not my own. My name is David Valentine.
Post turned over in his bunk, lying on his side. He put the bottle on the floor between them.
Okay, you got a false name. I don't get it. What is it then, an escape attempt? Damn elaborate one. You'd better pick the right island. Go to the wrong one and the residents will eat you alive. I mean that literally.
I need the Thunderbolt, and I'm gonna take it.
Valentine let the words sink in for a moment. Post's face rippled from blank astonishment to incredulity, then back again to astonishment as the idea took hold.
The original plan was to try with a small group of men I would bring on board. That didn't work out, so I'm gonna make do with what's already on the ship. The chief is on our side, and so is Anka, the grog foreman.
Our side? Whose side is that?
Southern Command. I work for one of the freeholds, the one in the Ozarks and Washitas. I'd like you to join us, if you'll risk it.
Post reached for the bottle and took a drink, ignoring his glass.
The sun's gone to your head, Dave. What are you going to try to do, turn the crew? They didn't get this job by being unreliable. Plus, they have families back home to think about.
The families will be taken care of. It's in the works right now. In a few more days, they'll be on their way out of the KZ. One of our cats is on the inside.
Cats?
Valentine's hypersensitive ears searched the adjoining rooms and corridor. Someone moved through the passageway, and he paused before continuing.
It's a nickname, I guess. It's a long story, but the Kerr and the Grogs aren't the only ones here from elsewhere. Earth is part of a larger war, and other worlds are involved. The Kurians are what you might call a faction of people called the Life Weavers. Their society split thousands and thousands of years ago when the Life Weavers on a planet called Kerr discovered how to become immortal through, I call it vampirism. They've been at war ever since. Way back then, the Kurians came here, and the Life Weavers picked some people to hunt the things brought over from Kerr. They explained to the primitive men that they were placing the spirit of wolves or bears or lions or what have you into the warriors they chose. I still don't know what they do exactly or how. All I can compare it to is turning on something inside you, like a light going on once you close the circuit. There was a hiatus lasting about 6,000 years when the Life Weavers won and Kerr's transportation network got closed down. We turned into a civilization in the gap. Then they came back, and the Life Weavers appeared again to help us.
Valentine looked at Post. He wondered if his lieutenant thought him a lunatic or simply an imaginative liar.
I've heard rumors. Weird stuff about men who can become invisible or breathe water or wrestle a reaper to the ground. Is that what you can do?
None of those. I can see and hear better, and they did something to quicken my reflexes. But that doesn't help me with this, at least now. The best hearing in the world isn't going to help me take this ship. But you could.
Valentine felt relieved for some reason. Something had felt wrong in keeping up the pretense in front of Post. Having a man he instinctively liked believing him a tool of the Kurians grated.
I'm not the only discontented one, just the only one that shows it. But you tell most of the men what you just told me, they'll claim they're in with you, and 2 minutes later go straight to the captain, claim the terrorist bounty. It's big enough to live on for a year if you catch a real one.
Post, in the KZ, the rest of your life is whatever the Kurian in charge wants it to be. In the Ozarks, you're not livestock. You're an individual, part of a community. It's not old world, at least not in material terms, but the old beliefs are there. Life has value.
Some community. I've heard you folks are so hungry when winter comes you live off the dead.
This was not the first time Valentine had heard that grisly rumor. He was happy to gainsay it rather than cite invented facts to support it.
Not true. I will say we don't eat as well as a lot of folks in the KZ, but then we're not being fattened for the slaughter either. I'm offering you a way out of all this, Will. A real escape. Not like the bottle you're using now. More. A chance to fight back. You'll be with men and women working to smash the system.
Post picked up the nearly empty bottle and looked at the mouth in a sidelong way, as if it were playing some kind of tune only he could hear. He shut his eyes and opened them again, staring straight at Valentine. Post extended his hand.
It ain't gonna work, Dave. But maybe you won't die alone.
They shook on it. A long moment passed, and Post sat back down in his bunk. He wiped his face, turning the gesture into a long, thoughtful pull at his chin. Valentine slipped back into his pants and shoes and left the cabin for a moment, passed the word for the officer's steward to bring some sandwiches to his cabin. He stepped out onto the after deck, felt the engines through the rail. The grogs were hurrying to finish up their duties, looking forward to an evening's rest, and off-duty Marines and sailors lounged around the deck, playing games of card and dice, or sitting absorbed in wood carving, reading, or just talking. He smelled the men's dinners below, the sea air, and the oily smell of the diesels. When he returned to the cabin, Post had his footlocker open and was unwrapping a burnished steel pistol from a terry cloth rag. A matching gun lay on his bed.
I wasn't planning on moving this minute.
I hope not. I'm too drunk to shoot straight. Thought you might want something to replace that 44 wheel gun you lost. Some mementos of my bright and shining youth.
He handed an automatic to Valentine.
Got a 45 caliber shell that should stop just about anyone, good and permanent. Bought this pair fresh out of officer's training.
Valentine tested the slide. The weapon was in fine condition.
Take one, Dave. Shoots faster than that revolver ever could.
Happy to.
Post also presented him with magazines of freshly loaded ammunition for the weapon.
Are the bullets reliable?
Better than most. Not service issue. They come from a gunsmith in the old town. He's a good man, as long as you treat him right. I heard that a major went out one time, threw his weight around to get a free gun, and damned if his pistol didn't misfire just when he needed it.
The sandwiches arrived, accompanied by a gumbo soup made of the scraps of the fresh meats brought out of New Orleans. They pulled out a mini-desk between their bunks and ate in thoughtful silence, mopping up the remnants of the soup with the ship's fresh bread. For the first time since Valentine started eating with Post, his lieutenant did not wash down his meal with half the contents of one of the iodine-colored bottles.
Can you tell me what you need the ship for?
Ankh would take over if I were killed. But if by chance both of us...
Valentine had committed himself, and if he could trust Post with his life, he could trust him with the few details that he knew.
I'm to find a stash of old weapons. I don't know what kind. Then I'm supposed to get them back, either going through Galveston or farther south by Mexico. That's the reason for the armed ship. It's supposed to help at the island and then make sure nothing can challenge us on the way back. There's a man in southern Texas who will take it from there.
Why don't they tell you what it is?
I think the danger is that if the Kurians found out about it, they'd either take it themselves or destroy it.
Valentine heard someone in the passageway outside and held up his hand for silence. After a moment, Valentine dropped his hand.
Where is it?
Haiti.
Haiti? Jesus. I figured it was the old naval base at Guantanamo. Sir, Haiti's hell's own greenhouse. It's pretty fucking big, and I never heard of anyone getting inland out of range of the ship's guns and coming back to tell about it.
I know roughly where on the island I'm supposed to go. There's some kind of traitor in the Kurian organization there who'll teach us about it. I know it'll be bulky. That's why we need a ship and so many men for the job.
There's an awful lot of ifs in your plan, if you don't mind me saying, sir.
I know. I'm not asking you to follow me inland. I was counting on you to run things on the ship until I return.
Sir, you want a weapon. Think about this ship. She's well-armored, carries a good-sized gun, and you could put enough men on her to shut down water traffic from Louisiana to Florida.
Any other time you'd be right, Will. but they tell me that whatever's waiting on Haiti is something that could really change the equation between us and the Kurians. Don't you think the risk is worth a chance to make a difference?
Some difference? Seems to me the difference will be the one between being alive and being dead. Not that I really care.
To his credit, Valentine thought, he did not sound convinced of the last. From that dinner on, Valentine did not see Post take another drink. His lieutenant suffered unvoiced agonies in silence, driving himself to keep up an appearance of stability in front of others, only to flee to the head or the cabin when the shaking in his hands got to be too much for him. Valentine never asked him to quit drinking. In fact, with the mental strain, he was more than a little tempted to try the contents of the squared-off bottles himself after retiring at night. Valentine found a growing new respect for Post that replaced his previous feelings of pity. He admired his lieutenant for keeping the pretense of normality despite the torrents of sweat pouring out of him and God knew what other torments to his body. The next evening, Valentine arranged for a meeting in the arms locker with the chief, Post, Anka, and himself, purportedly to determine which weapons Anka's grogs would carry in their duties. The captain had suggested a brace of dusty shotguns, captured in some action long ago and forgotten. After viewing the weapons in question, Valentine asked that the chief take a look at them and see if the ship's machine shop could bring them back to usability. Thus, the conspirators were able to get a half hour or so of privacy within the ship for a meeting of their group. Squeezing Anka's bulk into the room proved to be only the first difficulty in a long line of challenges before them.
We should make landfall off Jamaica tomorrow afternoon or early evening. The captain plans to head straight into the harbor the pirates are thought to use the next morning. God knows what might happen in the fight, so I think we have to move before then.
How about we go into action and rig a shell to blow on the bridge during the fight? The crew will think the pirates just got a lucky shot. Mr. Rowan assumes command. Looks legit.
Who knows what damage the explosion would do?
Sweat was running from Post's hairline under the hot work lamp. The Marine was balling his hands into fists and rubbing them against his thighs under the weapon-strewn table.
Maybe we go aground. So much for the Thunderbolt. I doubt the pirates would fix her up and take her to Haiti to oblige us.
Yes, and we might not get both. The exec will probably be at the main armament. I think it's better if we do it before. Offer the men an alternative to the fight. Freedom. That's a powerful persuader.
Anka quoted a grog proverb.
Cut off the head, and the body will be yours.
He was squeezed between the rifle racks, filling up one whole end of the room.
We have much of the head of the ship here. We removed the captain and Worthington. Then we let the petty officers know who is in charge. They will do as they are told.
Anka is right as far as the captain and exec go. But I want to give everyone else a real choice. We assemble the crew and give each man the option. Join us, or be put off the ship in a boat with food, water, even weapons. They can take their chances on Jamaica or try to sail for the coast. All they have to do is go north. They'll hit Kurian territory soon enough.
You go and tell them why you need a ship?
Can't risk it until the captain and the exec disappear with the crew that want to follow them. I have no idea how long we would be on Haiti. The last thing we need is him trying to hunt us down.
Post shook his head.
You'll lose half of them, maybe more. We might not be left with enough to keep this bucket moving.
I think a lot of them signed on for sea service to get away from the Reapers. You can tell by their talk, their interests. They're free spirits, not conscripts.
They hashed out the rest of the plan while working on the shotguns. They decided they would let a few subordinates they felt could be trusted know about the plan at the last minute. Post felt that he knew two Marines well enough to say they would follow him, and the chief insisted that his engine room crew would sign on to a man. Anka said the grogs would do as he ordered. Few of the humans on board could even make themselves understood to the creatures beyond simple instructions. They would take the ship in the dark after making landfall at Jamaica. The captain planned, as soon as he got his bearings, to move east along Jamaica's north coast and arrive at the pirate bay with the dawn. Around midnight, Anka would go below and guard the arms locker with his grogs, also controlling the nearby hatches to the engine room and generator room. The chief would kill the power when this was accomplished. Post and the Marines he hoped to recruit would go to the small store of ready arms on deck and mount machine guns fore and aft, covering the main decks from the gun platforms. It would be Valentine's job to take the bridge, doing whatever was necessary to keep Captain Saunders and Worthington from issuing any orders. With that accomplished, Valentine would assemble all hands on the deck and offer them their choice. There was some dispute over what to do with the captain and the executive officer.
He'll probably have to kill them, sir.
I'd rather not. I'll get a pair of handcuffs on them and toss them in the motor launch, or the lifeboat, depending on how many of the crew decide to go with them.
It will come to killing. They will turn the crew against you if they can.
Handcuffs and gags, then. I don't want their blood on our hands, unless it's a matter of us or them.
Valentine spent the next day lost in his duties, so much so that he did not go up on deck as they caught their first sight of the blue Jamaican coast. In preparation for the next morning's activities, which he hoped would never be carried out, he and his NCOs attached reflective tape to the backs of their green and black camouflage battle dress. Someone joked that Irish, a coastal marine corporal in their complement, should form his into the shape of a bullseye, since he'd managed to get himself shot 4 times in the course of his duties, and even Post laughed. At the midday meal, Anka and the Marines held an informal meeting in the crew's mess, where they went over the destruction the Thunderbolt was to visit on the pirates. Saunders hoped to reach the harbor before midnight. Valentine's imagination continued to get the better of him as the afternoon wore on. It seemed the entire ship crackled with electricity. So tense were the men and their officers in anticipation of the fight tomorrow.
I hope the chief is doing better than I am.
Post joined Valentine at sunset at the ship's starboard rail. They watched the thickly forested slopes of Jamaica slide by like a rolling backdrop in a stage play. Post still trembled, and his shirt was soaked with sweat, but his face seemed more animated and his eyes brighter.
I tried sounding out a few of the men, but I chickened out at the last moment. I just couldn't bring myself to say what we're planning. The moment didn't seem right. I kept thinking about a hood at my throat. Got so I could almost feel teeth. About all I was able to do was warn them to be ready for anything. Sorry, Dave.
Valentine shrugged.
Too late to worry. I talked to Anka and the chief. We're going to switch the time to 2200. The men are supposed to be assembled an hour later, ready to climb into the boats for the landing. That way, Anka leading his grogs to the arms locker won't seem so unusual. They're supposed to go ashore first anyway.
They forced themselves to act normally at dinner with the men. Valentine sat with one group he called his dead eyes, the 4 best marksmen in the called company. Post ate with the non-commissioned officers at the other long table in the galley. Though he had no appetite, Valentine forced himself to eat mouthful after mouthful of the traditional pre-action steak and eggs. The beef was stringy and tough, but even the Thunderbolt's indifferent cook's mate could not ruin the eggs. Valentine forced himself to have seconds on the latter, washing it down with glassfuls of faintly orange-tasting sweetened water that he guessed to be some concoction trying to pass as orange juice. He joked with the men, listening to service stories and telling a few of his own, like the time a supply officer fed an entire harem of young women in the loft of a marine warehouse, which grew into a thriving bordello over the years. When caught by a visiting inspector, he argued that pimping a whorehouse fell under his duties, since one of his official responsibilities was listed on his duty sheet as Recreation Procurement Officer. With dinner finished, the Marines broke off to leave the galley to the sailors, and Valentine returned to his shared cabin. He looked around the close, bare room. A single locker held all his clothes, and a footlocker the rest of his belongings. He spent an hour in a long shower and shave, and changed into his heavy cotton battle dress. The combat fatigues, acquired from a tailor in Mobile when he first entered the Coastal Marines, were a tiger stripe mix of black and dark green, spotted here and there with blotches of dark gray. Heavy pockets hung like saddlebags from the side of each thigh on the pants, but the short officer's tunic held only insignia and an expanding map pocket and a pencil holder on one sleeve. He unlocked his chest and began to take out his equipment. He laced up his boots, traditional black service models, the leather softened and oiled by a year's wear and care. His final wardrobe item was a nylon equipment vest with heavy bullet-stopping pads slipped into the liner and compass, flares, first aid kit, matches, and whistle distributed among the pockets. Post .45 caliber pistol went into his hip holster. Valentine sank a machete into the sheath strapped across his back, hanging over two canteens. Finally, he extracted the one item he brought out of the Ozarks, his old Soviet-Russian PPD model submachine gun with the drum clip. It was a heavy-barreled, formidable-looking gun, restored by an old friend and given to him the summer he became a cat 3 years ago. Slinging the gun and drawing comfort from its familiar weight, Valentine made a slow circuit of the Thunderbolt's central superstructure. Anka had the grogs gathered on the well deck, talking to them. The Golden One looked up at Valentine and cocked his ears up and forward, giving his broad head the momentary aspect of a bull, his friend's equivalent of a thumbs up. The gesture went to Valentine's nerves like a fast-acting sedative. He looked out at the nearly empty aft decks and turned the last corner on the rectangular walkway. Post stood at the foot of one of the stairways going up to the bridge deck, idling next to the arms locker, holding the machine gun for the forward mount. Valentine squeezed past and gave him a nod.
Ready?
Getting there. Sure makes you feel alive, doesn't it? Like the whole world's been turned up. Sounds, smells, everything. I never noticed all the ways before, a million of them.
Just take it easy, Will. Wait for me to go up the stairs, then get the gun. You checked it, right?
Yes, it's fine.
Just a few minutes longer. Anka's still talking to his team. They haven't gone below yet.
Post gripped the rail, the tendons in his forearms rising up under his tan skin.
You know why my wife lit out, Rowan? Dave?
I might be able to guess. The system?
The system. She and I had a difference of opinion about it. She left. I eventually came round to her side, but only after her stuff had 2 years' worth of dust on it.
Post looked out at the ocean and the sinking moon. Valentine thought he saw the man's lower lip tremble.
I gotta get rid of this shit.
Post tore off his tunic. Post stood in his stained undershirt for a moment, as if coming to a decision. He wadded up his uniform coat and fed it to the all-consuming sea.
If I'm gonna buy it, I don't want to go in their colors.
I'll get you a different one when we get back to free soil, if you'd like. Just try to live to claim it. I hope the exec doesn't come down those stairs and see you like that. You might have a few questions about your tunic.
I'll pick him up and send him to look for it. He's a bottom feeder if there ever was one. Could you do me a favor, Dave? If I don't make it, maybe you can look up Gale in the Free Territory. She would have headed that way. It's an easier trip than going across Texas. She's probably using her maiden name, Gale Stark. Just tell her about this.
Can do, Will.
Thanks, sir.
See you at Lights Out.
Post offered his hand.
Good luck, Dave.
Valentine shook it and went forward to look down at the well deck. It was empty. Anka and his grogs were already on their way to the arms locker and engine room. A nervous thrill sparked up his spine, bristling the hair at the back of his neck. He chambered the first round in his gun and lightly ascended the stairs to the open deck just behind the wheelhouse. As his head broke the level of the upper deck, Valentine listened with hard ears to voices from the bridge.
When is this supposed to happen?
Early in the morning, sir. The ship's power will be cut off, and that's when they'll take the ship.
Can't argue it. There's something afoot, that's for certain. Damn. There always was something about Rowan I didn't like. Haven't I said so time and again, Lieutenant?
Worthington changed the subject.
I've already alerted the Master at Arms. I didn't know which Marines to trust. Dortmund is bringing up the armed guards now, and he's...
Valentine's worries cleared, as they always did when planning gave way to doing. All his questions were gone. It had become a matter of killing everyone on the bridge and somehow holding the wheelhouse and upper deck through the coming confusion. The moon had disappeared below the horizon, leaving the ship lit only by the stars and its few running lights.
Halt!
Valentine heard a voice boom from the bottom of the staircase.
Unsling your weapon, sir, and don't touch anything but the sling.
He turned to see Dortmund, three sailors lined up behind him, pistols pointed up at him. While he had been concentrating on the bridge, Dortmund had reached the bottom of the stairs without Valentine noticing. Valentine thanked God that Dortmund hadn't shot first and questioned later. He obeyed the instructions, going so far as to crouch to put the gun on the stair below his feet and readied himself for a leap. When the loud, deadly rattle of a machine gun roared from behind the sailors, Dortmund's men fell forward, jerking spasmodically as if swept off their feet by an electrified broom. The four-petal blossom of the machine gun's muzzle flare lit Post's snarling features as he fired the support weapon from his hip, using a thick leather strap to help him wield it. One sailor went overboard. The others fell at the bottom of the stairs. Valentine retrieved his own gun before they hit the deck. Blood had been shed, and his hopes of a simple seizure of the ship were cut down as brutally as Dortmund and his henchmen. He peeked over the edge of the deck above, only to be met by a burst of bullets that zipped out to sea past his ear. Worthington was no fool. He had armed himself before going to the captain. Valentine had to get down to Anka and his grogs so he would at least have a nucleus of armed men to command. The lights died, and Valentine felt a change in the ship's motion. The chief had level-headedly proceeded with the plan upon hearing the firing above. Valentine backed down the stairs and joined post, where his lieutenant covered the starboard side walkway from the base of the stairs.
What the hell happened? Where did Dortmund come from?
One of the ship's boys overheard something and went to the exec. We gotta get to the grogs.
The ship's public address system squealed into static-filled life.
All hands! All hands! This is the captain speaking.
Valentine grabbed Post by the arm and pulled him into the stairwell leading into the bowels of the ship, almost jerking him out of his shoes with the force of his movement. Two shots rang out from the top of the stairway, cutting the air where they stood seconds ago, as Saunders' voice continued.
Captain Rowan of the Marines, Lieutenant Post, the Grogs, and an unknown number of others are attempting to mutiny. They are to be shot on sight. All hands to the aft deck. All hands to the aft deck.
Make a hole, damn it! Make a hole!
As Valentine exited the stairway with Post in tow, he waved his submachine gun to accentuate the threat as they pushed back sailors popping like magical rabbits into the narrow passageway. Somewhere around the T-junction corner ahead, he heard Anka's bellow, barking out orders in the grog patois. The captain's voice continued to issue orders over the PA, including one to the dead Dortmund to report to the Orlikon. An emergency light bathed the corridor in harsh shadows. Valentine turned a corner and caught sight of a knot of grogs standing behind a small, bright spotlight pointed down the corridor. He shielded his eyes.
Anka, it's me and Post. Cut that light for a second.
The two men hustled toward the improvised barricade. A pistol fired from the darkness behind them. Post sagged against Valentine, who turned and fired up the passageway. Anka leapt forward with apish agility, blocked the floodlight with his bulk, and put his mammoth arm around Post's chest. The machine gun clattered to the steel floor, but Post gripped the strap as Anka dragged him backwards. Valentine backed down the corridor, but whoever fired stayed safely around the corner of the intersection at the end of the hall. He reached the grogs outside the arms locker. Anka had improvised a barricade of mattresses and a wooden door, which the muscular grogs still worked to construct as they shifted a beam to let them pass. Anka carried Post into the arms locker and gently stretched him out onto the floor. Valentine knelt beside his lieutenant, who had blood staining the undershirt across his chest.
I can taste blood.
Valentine found the wound, high enough on his chest to nearly be at the shoulder. He grabbed a first aid kit off the wall and found a compress within. He applied the dressing to the softly pulsing hole. Noticing blood on the floor, he gently lifted Post and found another hole opposite.
Good news, Will. It went straight through.
Watch. Oh, the captain will have the Marines on you in a minute.
Most of them won't be armed. All they'll have are whatever guns are scattered on the ship.
Stern! He'll send men down the hatches.
Post was pale with pain, but still thinking clearly enough. His bravery gave Valentine heart.
We've blocked everything off.
Anka stood in the doorway.
The chief is welding the access hatches shut.
They heard a clatter around the shadowed corner of the T-intersection facing the barricade. Anka knelt beside the mattress-shielded door, the pump action in his hands looking like a child's toy.
Mr. Rowan!
A voice called down the hall.
It's Partridge! I've got Wenton Torres with me! What's happening, sir?
Valentine exchanged a look with Anka and mouthed the word Marines.
I don't have time for the whole story, Party, but everything the captain said over the intercom is true. Post is with me. We're trying to take the ship.
What are you talking to him for?
The voice came from around the right-hand corner of the intersection.
Shut up, CP. It's our officer.
Valentine recognized Torres's voice.
You planning on going into the blue, sir?
Something like that. It's a life away from the Reapers to any man who comes with me.
You move and I'll shoot you down.
Hey, what are you...
The three Marines appeared in the corridor, Torres and Wendt holding the wounded Partridge between them. They squinted in the glare of the spotlight, holding up their free hands. Torres had a revolver in his, and Wendt a rifle. The Marines approached the barricade.
Bastards! You killed Delano!
Anka plucked the wounded man over and bore him into the arms locker and put him down next to Post. Partridge already had blood soaking through the right side of his uniform. Valentine helped the other two.
We're with you, Mr. Rowan.
The speaker, Wendt, was one of Valentine's deadeyes.
When we heard the announcement, party, he said, who'd you rather take orders from, Saunders or Mr. Rowan? I grabbed my match rifle and Torres got Corporal Grant's pistol and we came to see what was happening. Now that bastard Delano fired first, sir, and we shot back. Everything's dark and confused. I heard firing forward. I think everyone's shooting at each other.
I'm glad you're here, Wendt. I want to be straight with you. This is not going as I planned. It's us, the Groggs, and the Chief, and a few of his men. We're outnumbered about 8-1.
The corners of Wendt's mouth twitched back into something that, if not a smile, was at least a wry grimace.
Leastways, the guns are here.
He peered over the edge of the barricade.
They won't take me alive. I'm not going to get delivered and handcuffed to some hood.
The hatch to the generator room at the bottom level of the ship opened, and the Chief's face looked up at the assembled Groggs and men.
Oh, tight as a drum. They're going to have to blow a big hole in the ship to get at us from down here. Captain going to have an interesting time commanding a ship without engines.
Good work, Chief.
Valentine heard a commotion down the hall and sought out the location with hard ears. The captain was speaking to someone, demanding a report. Saunders did not care for the answers.
That's all? And you let men join them?
They shot Delano, sir. And he had the only gun right then.
You've got a wrench in your hands. You should have bashed some skulls in with it. Out of my sight!
After a moment, Valentine heard Saunders again, this time projecting from somewhere along the starboard side corridor.
The attempt on the ship has failed, Rowan. You know it. And I'm sure it's starting to dawn on those deluded enough to follow you.
We're ready to wreck the engines, Captain, if we come to believe that.
You're a dead man, Rowan, and so's your pet drunk. But I'm offering an amnesty to whoever turns you in. I'll hush all this up, like it never happened, long as they frog march you and Post out.
Valentine looked over his shoulder. Torres and Wendt were both looking at him. He read doubt in their expressions, but whether it was doubt in him or doubt in the captain's promise, he could not say. He slowly placed his gun on the floor, butt end pointed at the Marines.
Takers?
Wendt blanched, but Torres just smiled and shook his head. Partridge groaned something from his position on the floor of the arms locker.
What was that?
Valentine asked Torres, who knelt beside the wounded man.
Tell Captain Saunders to go fuck himself.
We put it to a vote, Captain, and it's unanimous. Go fuck yourself.
Valentine picked up his gun.
Damn you to hell, Rowan! You'll all bleed, you renegade bastards!
Tell me, sir, what happened to the last captain that failed in a mission because of a mutiny? I heard Kurian's ordered that—
By Kerr, Rowan, I'll make it so hot for you, you'll wish you were in hell. I'll kill all you. You'll beg me to let you die, renegade.
Torres disappeared into the arms locker and returned, scooting up toward Valentine with something in his hand. Valentine recognized the can-shaped object as one of the ship's grenades.
You play pool much, Mr. Rowan?
Torres put two fingers into the ring atop the explosive.
Not my game, Torres.
Can I try a two-bumper shot?
Be my guest.
Torres pulled the pin and listened for the hiss. Valentine saw a thin wisp of smoke appear from the central fixture that held the fuse. The Marine stood and, with a left-handed sidearm throw, sent the grenade spinning down the corridor, whirling like a gyroscope toward the voice of the captain. Valentine kept his head up long enough to see it bounce off the bullet-marked wall at the crossbar of the T-intersection and heard it hit again somewhere in the corridor corner leading to the starboard passageway.
Grenade! Look out!
As the ringing noise faded from their ears, Valentine felt the sweat running down the skin over his spine.
About time for the captain to try something really stupid.
The captain obliged him. The loyal sailors and Marines of the Thunderbolt tried to take the barricade with a rush. One of the machine guns from the upper deck appeared around the port side corner and began firing blindly toward the barricade. Valentine and Torres knelt behind the mattress-reinforced door, while the others took cover in rooms off the main passageway. The mattresses slowed down even the large caliber shells enough, so they failed to do more than dig into the solid wood. When the gun's belt ran out, the corridor filled with screaming attackers trying to rush the barricade under the cover of a few pistols in the front ranks. The spotlight lit them up with unearthly clarity, ghostly faces white and straining. Anka lifted the machine gun Post had dragged with him and, firing from his shoulder, swept the corridor, cutting down the attackers running at them two abreast. Valentine added short bursts from his own gun. They flung the men down into bloody heaps well before the hopeless attack reached the barricade. A pair of men dodged into the dark laundry room, only to be hurled out again by shotgun blasts from Anka's grogs waiting within. The charge was bloody but brief, and when it was over, Valentine counted 11 dead and wounded heaped in the corridor, lying in a thin lake of spilled blood under spattered walls. Only their blood penetrated the barricade, seeping in under the mattresses and door until its odor overwhelmed even the cordite in the air. Valentine sank to his knees, reloading.
Last thing I wanted. This is not what I wanted. Not what I wanted.
He felt himself waltzing on the edge of hysteria. Anka placed a reassuring hand on his shoulder.
Steady now, my David. Better them than us.
A figure arose from the bloody heap in the corridor, pushed up by an arm and his one good leg. The Marine tried to take a step back toward the intersection when he slipped on the slick red liquid pooled on the floor, falling full on his injured leg.
Would you help Cal before he bleeds to death?
You won't shoot?
No, for God's sake, get him, would you?
The tacit truce allowed a pair of sailors to pull the wounded men away around the corridor. Anka placed a new belt in his machine gun, closing the receiver with a determined slam. Went gestured to Valentine from the weapons room.
Partridge died. Sorry, Mr. Rowan. And I think Mr. Post is in shock.
Valentine crawled into the locker and felt Post's pulse. It was weak but steady, his breathing shallow. A half-familiar burning smell tickled Valentine's nostrils. He looked up at the ceiling, where smoke began to flow from an air supply vent. He moved to the hatch to the engine room.
Chief, looks like they're burning something in the ventilators. Can you do anything about it?
Oh yeah, I noticed that. I'm turning off the fans now. The access to the smokestack is welded shut. Otherwise, I could shunt it out of there. It's gonna get smoky, especially if they burn something in the stairway too.
How about reversing the fans?
Nah, we have to rewire them. We're just gonna have to cough for a while, I think.
The squawk box crackled to life.
Last chance, men. We've got some fires going in the ventilators, and we'll be dropping bits of the ventilator tire on for good measure. It's going to get unpleasant down there in a few minutes, if not lethal. Anyone who comes to their senses will get mercy. Too much has happened for it to get covered up now, but I'll do what I can.
Why can't you shut him up, Chief?
Seemingly deaf to the captain's gloating words, Torres solemnly laid his tunic over Partridge's head.
It's on the emergency battery up on the bridge. I mean, I could cut the wires, I suppose.
Anka wrinkled his nose.
Disgusting.
The harsh smell of burning rubber filling the room caused Valentine's eyes to water.
Try this.
The chief passed him a damp rag. Valentine imitated the chief and his men by tying the cloth over his mouth and nose. He did not notice a difference.